Woof. Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back as we continue going through our favorite 100 movies of all time. It is episode number 89, and this is our 12th favorite movies of all time. The top 10 is right around the corner. We're talking Baby Driver from 2017 and Psycho from 1960. It's been about 2 weeks since we've been here, so thank you all for coming back. Next week, we're going to be doing our Oscar predictions. I've beaten John twice. Don't forget it. I've beaten him twice. Even though he always watches all the movies and I don't, I still have to get through Elvis and Tar so I can at least watch all the Best Picture nominees. No way I'm getting all the other awards. However, this is a wide open year, man. We'll be talking about that next week. But, man, Brendan Fraser just pulled off the SAG win. Right now, it seems like what's his name from Everywhere, Everything, All at Once is probably the favorite for Best Supporting Actor, but we could see Barry Keoghan still win because he won the BAFTA or something. This is the most wide open, and Cate Blanchett lost.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
Yeah. The only thing I do know for certain, and I do that as I hold this Spindrift, which I don't really like this, but I hold this as I drink this, and I might cringe a couple times. Avatar 2 is not winning any meaningful awards at this year's Oscars. And we'll talk about that movie next week because it doesn't deserve more than the 192 minutes it sucked away from my life. But we're here to talk about good movies, and that's Psycho and Baby Driver. And look, for anybody who sits here and tells me that you can say anything you want about Avatar 2, but you can't deny that it looks good, I'm denying it right now. It doesn't even look good. And I'm going to say this. Baby Driver looks better. And Psycho, which was made 63 years ago, looks better. So anyway, here we are. We're here to talk good ones. John, how you been? It's been a little bit.
It's been great. I've been great. I just got back from L.A.
How have you been great if you just got back from L.A.?
I was in L.A. when it was like Canadian weather. So, you know, It was the exact same thing I was already used to.
Gotcha. I wasn't talking about from a weather standpoint. I was just talking about from the city as a whole, you know.
But, yeah, well, the city as a whole is a wholly different story. Everything's very far apart and very expensive. Not quite sure why people live there, but I guess they do.
Yeah. Hey, man, you want to travel to see your friend who lives 2 hours away in Los Angeles? You don't even question it. I live in Florida now. If somebody lives 2 hours away, they might as well live in a different country. So Anyway, but you went to Universal, and that made you happy. And you went to the Chinese Theater. You did do some big movie buff specialist things.
I did like the quintessential movie buff specialist things while I was down there. Went to the Chinese Theater, saw Ant-Man Quantumania for the second time in theaters for some reason. But I saw it in 4D. That was weird. And yeah, I went to Universal Studios. Sorry?
What did it smell like if you saw it in 4D?
Only bad smells.
Okay.
Like, never a good smell. It was just, like, dog shit every single time.
Okay.
I went to Universal Studios and got to take the studio tour and see the set of Psycho. So it felt great.
There you go. That's good timing, man. Well done. Well, you're back. You're back in the safety of Vancouver Island or wherever you are, and you're not in L.A. anymore. So congratulations for that. All right, so Psycho and Baby Driver, two very different movies, came out 57 years apart. One of them considered one of the all-time greatest movies, and one of them considered a movie that came out in 2017. So I'm interested to talk about these two because they are very different. Iconic horror, and Edgar Wright, just pretty much at this point, it's like well known that if he has a movie that's going to come out, it's going to be very entertaining, and it's going to go pretty much disregarded by people who aren't fans of just his movies. But let's start with Baby Driver, John, since it is the lesser of like in terms of like what people are talking about. People are talking about Baby Driver a lot less than Psycho.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what? That's understandable. Baby Driver's still new. Baby Driver holds a really special spot in my heart. This is the first movie I saw after I moved to the middle of nowhere. I was on a trip with my ex, and we were at a conference. And I was like, I'm going to go see a movie by myself. And it was Baby Driver. And I fell in love with it. Edgar Wright really doesn't miss at this point. I think it's very safe to say Edgar Wright does not miss anymore. And it's really funny that I just mentioned Ant-Man because Edgar Wright leaving the first Ant-Man is the only reason we get this movie in the first place.
Yeah. Edgar Wright hasn't done a Marvel movie, right?
Well, he was supposed to do Ant-Man. And then there was some decisions that he didn't like coming down from the studio. And he was like, no, I'm going to go make my own heist movie. And he made Baby Driver instead.
Yeah, which is great. Edgar Wright makes some of the most entertaining movies. I had The World's End on my list. And I know you have Scott Pilgrim vs. the World coming up. I actually haven't seen Last Night in Soho, which I should. But Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz. You know, I mean, he makes very, very, very entertaining movies. And actually, when he made Shaun of the Dead, he was only 30 years old. So got started young. He's only 48 and he's made a bunch of hits already, which is always fun. But the thing with Baby Driver is I consider this a 4-star movie. I don't consider like this like one of the greatest movies or anything like that, but I consider this a 4-star movie. But there's no denying how entertaining this movie is. And the music choices, like even if you're not a big fan of all the songs in this, I think Edgar Wright did a good job of bouncing around from genre to genre enough that he kind of keeps you on your toes. And he lets you know that it's not about, do you actually like the song that's playing? Because like when you watch a Wes Anderson movie, if you're not into like indie music, most of the time you're not going to really appreciate Needle in the Hay or These Days or something like that. You can really appreciate all the music in this, even if you don't know what the hell you're listening to, because it's always fitting the scene. And instead of having a score, it just has these classic songs. And I mean, the use of Barry White in Bo's Diner is brilliant. Like, it's just brilliant because Barry White is just one of those guys who does not get the credit he deserves anymore, because really he had like 2 or 3 songs and like whatever. But that voice that Barry White had is just unreal. And he does get kind of overlooked now in like the Spotify generation, where you're not really buying albums and you're just listening, you know, whatever comes up. And if it doesn't fit into your algorithm, you don't hear it. I love that part so much, but this movie just has a rhythm and it just goes and it goes and it goes. And the character of Baby is a really entertaining character. I will say Lily James, not a very good accent in this movie. That like threw me off a little bit. Cute as a button, but the accent wasn't doing it for me. But all the side characters, Jamie Foxx is great. Rodriguez, I can never say her first name. I'm not going to say it correctly, but she's great. John Hamm is obviously amazing. And then Kevin Spacey, really in his last meaningful role, right? I mean, right after this was when all of the Me Too movement stuff came out and everything about him came out. And I'm not going to lie, I'm really good about separating the artist from the art. But this was a movie where that scene where he's with his nephew and the nephew's sitting in the back seat, and then you realize like a couple months later, all the allegations and everything that came out against him. I was like, I don't know how I would feel if I was that parent in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It is one of those movies that kind of makes you just question that thing. But still, like, it also makes you just like hate Kevin Spacey more for being a scumbag because he's such a good actor.
I know it's awful.
So good in this movie.
Yep. I know.
Yeah. But you're right. I really like what Edgar Wright does with this is this taking music and applying it to film in a way where he foregoes a score, uses all of these pre-existing songs, brings it together and uses it as a score still where we constantly have diegetic music throughout the film. Oh, almost all the music in this movie is diegetic, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah.
And it's choreographed. And we have to, like, we can't just call this, like, blocking scenes to music. It is, these scenes are choreographed to this music. And it is phenomenal how tight that correlation is.
Yeah. No, it's crazy because right from the beginning of this movie, they really set the tone with that car chase at the beginning. And they just let you know this is going to be a ridiculous car chase movie. But like you said, it's that beat. I mean, I got to start the song over. That part is so great when he just says, I have to start the song over. And then it's, okay, now you can go. Like, I love that because that's the type of stuff, like if you're driving in your car alone, you will do that, right? It didn't feel right that time. Oh, I was zoned out. I got to put that back on. Like, but I always say this, like my wife, we drove from California to Florida and I drive all over the place. She like, I could be a truck driver. I love driving, but it drives her crazy because like when we go on these road trips, a lot of people are like, well, we're going to drive 10 hours in the day. I got to listen to upbeat music. So I have the energy going. Yeah. I listen to songs. I'll listen to Julian Baker. I'll listen to Phoebe Bridgers. I'll listen to Lana Del Rey. I'll listen to like this depressing, really like whatever stuff, because I don't care if it's upbeat. I care that I know it. And if I know it, I can get into it and I can get into the rhythm of it and I can feel it and then I'm in it. And that's what this movie captures. And I don't think I've ever seen a movie capture that the way that Baby Driver does, where it's like, this isn't just it reminds me of when Linklater said to McConaughey, when he says, that's what I love about high school girls. You know, they say, I get older, they stay the same age. He said, that's not just what you say, that is what you live by. Mm-hmm. And I think Edgar Wright captured that this music is what Baby lives by. It's not just what he listens to, it's what he lives by. It's what gives his life purpose and meaning and allows him to be good at what he does. It's, I mean, I don't know how he captured that on film, but that within itself is unbelievably impressive.
And that's what makes, I think that's one of the things that really elevates Edgar Wright as a filmmaker, is his passion for film comes through in everything he's doing. I even wrote, like, yes, this is a heist movie, and it's a very good heist movie, and it understands the genre of heist movies and how to play with that for the impact that this film can have. This is also just a love letter to music in general. Like, you can tell this music that Edgar Wright chooses for this film, and I guarantee you he meticulously chose these pieces for this film. This is the music Edgar Wright just listens to, and that's how it makes it into this film.
Well, and yeah, I think like that's what a lot of people will try to do, but Edgar Wright also makes it feel like his character must listen to this. Whereas I think like sometimes when you watch like a lesser director, it starts to feel like, okay, this is just the greatest hits. You know, I always think like my Spotify top 100 from 2018, this is what I listen to, blah, blah, blah. They're not all going to fit into a movie well. Mm-hmm. There's an elevation to each song, like Bright and Rock of all the songs to have be that one. That's great. Like, that's just a great choice. And then you have the Deborah part with Beck and with T-Rex, where he calls it Trex. And she's Rex. Like, you mean T-Rex? Like, those little moments, and you know that in Edgar Wright's life, he definitely said Trex. Yeah. Like he had to be corrected to be like, oh, it's T-Rex. I didn't know that. But if you listen to Mott the Hoople, right? All the young dudes, they say T-Rex. I think they say T-Rex, but anyway. He manages to let you know it's not just his music. And I think that's why, because it's jumping from so many genres, that's where it almost doesn't feel like it's just Edgar Wright picking and choosing. It feels like this is the, and I have a different, I have a different iPod for each one. Like, it's great.
Yeah. And it's the moods of these iPods and the fact that we see how the different iPods are, right? You know, sometimes you're in a pink and sparkly mood.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're just in your classic iPod video mood. And the fact that they're all iPods, the fact that this isn't like, this movie comes out at the exact time where it can come out. Any later, this movie makes no sense because there's no way someone has this many iPods. Even in 2017, it's a little awkward to have that many iPods. But like, it just works with this film. And there are very few moments of this film where there is not music playing.
Yeah.
And in most of those moments, there's a tinnitus hum. Now, that might just be my own tinnitus, but I'm pretty sure it was coming from the movie.
No, there's a tinnitus hum.
And the only times you don't hear it is when music's playing. And it's just fascinating. It's fascinating how deep Edgar Wright goes into this. The fact that the film starts with the tinnitus, and then it moves into the diegetic sound of the brakes of the car to make you kind of not realize it's tinnitus until tinnitus gets mentioned later in the film. The fact that like this opening sequence is done without words. The only dialogue we get in this opening sequence is John Barenthal's character going, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
And then we don't get anything until they are clear and out and back with Doc. And it shows you what this type of movie is. It shows you how professional these criminals are at these heists that they're performing. And then we get, you know, those classic heist tropes of everyone coming together and building the team and everything. But it's set up in a way where Edgar Wright makes it seem like John Barenthal's character is going to be the main villain in this movie, replaces it with Jamie Foxx later, And then the main villain of this movie happens to be the other guy we're introduced to at the very beginning of the movie.
Yeah. Who really isn't the main villain until Baby kills his wife. I mean, really, John Hamm's motivation in this movie for like why he wants to kill Baby actually makes sense. Whereas Jamie Foxx is just a nut job. But as John Bernthal does, comes into a movie and then disappears way too early. He never sticks around. It drives me crazy. I was watching Wind River the other night, or like a couple weeks ago, and I'm like, my God, why is he not in more of this movie? I don't know if you saw Widows, the Steve McQueen movie. Like, why is John Bernthal not in longer, like in more of movies that he's in? He should be in more. He's a great actor. But yes, I love the sound choices. And one of my favorite parts of this movie is when he robs the old woman or steals her car and he gives her the purse back, and that's all great and everything. But it's him flipping through the stations trying to find music that will give him the rhythm that he needs to be able to go. It seems so ridiculous because of that moment you're in. But think about like back before Spotify and back before like people had iPods and everything like that. If you went in your car and you were driving to work, and I'm talking like 1997, 1998, you didn't have a CD player and your 8-track was broken. And so you went in your car and you're trying to find a good station. You would sit in your driveway until you found that station. Like you just would. I remember sitting in my dad's car and being like, are we going to leave? And he'd be like, well, I'm trying to find something before we start going. And it's like, nowadays we're all sitting here, we're staring at our phones, trying to get the right song to play while we're about to rear end the car in front of us. And we're both going 95 miles an hour. I mean, that's just, I mean, at least that's what we do in Florida. But I love that part. Like that's the attention to detail. We're going to talk about Boogie Nights in 2 weeks, which is my number 11. And there's a scene in Boogie Nights where they're going to the car and they have to unlock it by putting the key in the car. Mark Wahlberg's trying to walk away from Philip Seymour Hoffman or whatever the hell it is when Philip Seymour Hoffman's trying to come on to him. And it's that attention to detail that sets directors apart, right? I'm not saying that a director wouldn't notice that because, of course, they're going to like, oh, it's the 70s. We need to unlock the car by hand. But it's to show that. Give us that, to not just have him get in the car and a good song comes on. No, he has to get in the car and he has to find Radar Love, and Radar Love starts blasting. He only gets a part of it, but at least it helps him get away to where he needs to get away. I'm all about that. I think that's fantastic. And again, Edgar Wright, his movies are all about pace. People don't realize that, but great comedy is about pace and great action is about pace. And I would say Edgar Wright is the best at meshing comedy and action.
Yeah, I agree.
Better than anybody working today, for sure.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we're going to talk about that in 3 weeks when I have Scott Pilgrim, because it's the exact same deal. I mean, it leads more into the comedy than this one does the action, but like it is all pacing in that film.
Yep.
And the bigger thing that Edgar Wright paces in this film, though, is his character development of Baby is so subtle, but so well done. We see him, he's kind of this mysterious non-talking guy, and then he has these actions, right? It's the second pair of sunglasses he pulls out.
It's the third pair of sunglasses.
Yeah, at the third pair of sunglasses. it's him recording everything and then making music out of it. Like these are those little moments that really tell you so much about this character. And to notice that, like, he always had headphones in. Did you notice the one scene where he does not have earbuds in?
Isn't it the time when he's talking to her at the diner, or is it not?
It's the date.
It's the date. And that's when he thinks he's out, and then he gets pulled back in. He puts the headphones right back in.
Exactly. It's these little tiny details that Edgar Wright puts in this movie that makes it so excellent and so memorable. The thing is, like, you cannot watch this movie for years and you still probably remember 90% of it just because of the attention to detail that Edgar Wright puts into everything.
I hadn't seen this movie since it came out, and and I remembered most of this movie. I really did. I remembered most of it. I remembered all the interactions with Lily James. I remembered all the interactions with Kevin Spacey. Like, and what's nice about this movie is Edgar Wright doesn't get bogged down in some convoluted plot. It feels like it's going that way, but really it doesn't go that way. And I love the revelation when Kevin Spacey, those were my cops. Yeah, they were cops. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't have killed them. They were, I know they were cops, but they were working with and for me. But we don't get into who Kevin Spacey is or what he does. And we don't get into like all these other convoluted, how can we drag Baby into this? Really, most of them don't want Baby involved because they don't really trust him. They don't really know what's going on. So I think with a movie like Baby Driver, you talk about like Sound of Metal, right? That came out three years ago now, whatever it was.
Yeah.
That movie was sound. Like that movie was sound. Baby Driver, I think, puts a movie like that to shame because even though that movie has phenomenal sound design, Baby Driver just has it like in so many different ways, on so many different levels. And like you said, getting into the tinnitus and the different sounds of the car and her voice and making the music. I mean, I love that when they figure out like, how are you going to explain this? It's like, it's just something I do. And then they turn around and they're listening to him make all the stuff. Does he sound slow? Slow means this. Does he sound slow? Does he look slow? Like, it's great. Yeah. It really is. It's great.
Yeah. And I think part of the reason why this movie feels so good is because Baby as a protagonist is rootable. You know, he's been dragged in. We find out that he's been dragged in because he was boosting Doc's car and Doc let it happen because he was so impressed. So we get that, you know, that savant aspect of Baby. Mm-hmm. But we also know he wants out. He doesn't want to do this. He's only doing this to pay off a debt. But Doc knows, you'll come back though. We know how to get you back. We know about Joe. We know what you need to do to get you back here. And the real moment that I think sets Baby apart from most protagonists we would see in a heist movie is the moment where he sees the dead body at the second heist.
Yep.
And it's so important that Edgar Wright doesn't show him seeing him being killed there and that he just sees the dead body. And we get that reaction from Baby at that second heist scene is so good for so many reasons. We get Jamie Foxx's speech beforehand, which is absurd, but at the same time, it's like, yes, this is the mentality they're getting into. We have the Michael Myers masks.
The Michael Myers masks is so funny.
It's so funny. And did you know that it was supposed to be two Halloween masks and one Mike Myers mask?
No.
Originally?
Why'd they end up with three?
Couldn't get the rights to Halloween to use the mask. I love it. So Edgar Wright phoned Michael Myers and asked if it was okay to do this instead.
I love it.
Yeah.
I really do. That's phenomenal.
It's so funny, especially when you take into consideration everyone was supposed to buy their own mask. That's what the instruction was that Doc gave.
Yeah.
And they all got JD to get the mask instead, and it goes wrong because of it. And it's so funny.
Yeah. So funny, but then, like you said, has the heavy moment that is a turning point for Baby where he says, I don't want to do this anymore, but I have to do one more job so I can get even and whatever. And this way I can just be done with all of this. But, you know, it's whenever you get stuck with the man in that way, you can't ever get away. And he can't get away from Doc, and Doc knows he can't get away from him. But we do see this with Baby the entire time, and Baby doesn't want violence. Mm-hmm. And that's why the scene where he does decide to kill Jamie Foxx and just drive as hard as he can into the bed of the truck, which is how his mother died, is a really big moment because it's showing that characterization of like, I didn't want violence, but if I have to resort to it to protect myself, I will. And he ultimately kills Darling or whatever his name, Buddy, whatever John Hamm's name is in this movie. He ends up killing John Hamm because he has to, because it's his only way out. He goes, he serves his time. We see all the really nice things being said about him in the courthouse and everything. And we get like a romanticized ending, right? Of like, you know, five years later, she's still waiting for him and everything works out well for him. And that's good though, because that's the note that this movie should end on. You can't have him just get away and not go to jail because it's nonsense. But we see him save the bank teller. We see him do all these different things. I mean, that's the good stuff in a movie like this.
Yeah, and it's honestly what separates it from other movies of this genre, right? Like, it plays on these tropes of get the team together, explain the heist, we know what's going to happen. We know what's supposed to happen. We see it unfold. And we've seen other aspects of it where things go wrong, right? We've seen bats essentially make everything go wrong in every single moment, right? We have JD doing the small slip up. Bats is crazy, so he like kills JD and everything. And then bats is the reason why they have the tequila shootout.
Yep.
Another fantastic music scene. And you're led to believe that's why things are going to go wrong, because Bats has this bloodlust that he just needs to fill at all times. And then to see that moment where Baby switches and he takes matters into his own hands, it just defies the genre. Because in these heist movies, these people that are reluctantly working together tend to come together by the end of them. And in this case, we don't have that. We have someone who wants to be on the outside and stays on the outside as much as possible.
Yeah, exactly. And down to the fact of, like, even when they're talking about all the heists, he's still listening to music. And Doc knows that he's getting it all, and he knows what needs to be done. But he doesn't want to be involved in all of the conversation and everything. He doesn't want to get personal with any of them, because he wants out as much as he can possibly get out, which he obviously needs to kill everybody off in order for himself to get out. But I agree with you. I think that's a smart decision, because a lot of movies would just take what the trope is, and the trope is, okay, John Hamm and Baby are going to work together, and then one of these villains is going to decide to take the fall for Baby because they were hopeless anyway. That's it. Move on. Done. That doesn't happen in this movie. Baby Driver has to face the music. There it is. But he has to. He has to actually go to jail and do his time. I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It grounds the film a little. There's this dreamlike sequence at the end where it's like this release to the film, and you feel that it has this nice happy ending. But it's around this realism of, no, I have to atone for what I've done.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think of other things in this movie that I'm trying to think, like, what my, I don't have any other notes on it, but I'm trying to think of what else
the scene in the parking garage when, like, it's the confrontation between Buddy and Baby with Doc there right before Doc dies, that the cops are showing up. It's Buddy in the cop car. And then there's the red light on Buddy with the blue light on Baby. And it's just that juxtaposition shows really well the conflict that's about to arise.
Yeah.
It's those visual aspects. Edgar Wright is a very visually stunning director. And he puts a lot of thought into every moment he puts on film. And there's so much intention in it all. And that's just what we see in a scene like this.
Well, and I really think, like, this is the best movie acting John Hamm's ever done. Because Mad Men's the best work he's ever done. But I really think that this is the best movie acting John Hamm has ever done. And I think a lot of that does come down to, like, what Edgar Wright had him doing and the decisions Edgar Wright gave him. Like, John Hamm feels like the guy you want to be buddies with, but you know that he's going to flip a switch on you any second. Jamie Foxx, you know that he's just going to flip a switch. But John Hamm's character really does feel like somebody who, like, you could get along with. He's the one who's always kind of sticking up for Baby and all of that. But once you piss him off, now you've pissed him off and there's nothing you can do.
And what Edgar Wright does really well with that characterization is he sets it up in a scene where they stop at the gas station on the way to the gun sale. And Bats is in the gas station, like, you know, killing a guy for no reason. And Darling's talking with Buddy about how, you know, remember that time you shot that guy for me?
Yeah.
And he's like listing off the different times he shot people because of what happened. It's like, yeah. But when he looked funny, Bats looked at me funny just now, right?
And yeah.
Like, it's that moment where you realize, oh, like, Buddy feels like the Buddy character, and a lot of that comes down to his name too. The naming used for the character is very smart here to make him feel like a friend. The way he's been acting with Baby makes him feel like a friend. But in the end, he is still this hardened criminal that's a little off his rocker because he likes his drugs.
Yep. And what, he gets broken down immediately by Bats, who's like, this is what you did and you think you're so interesting, Wall Street. Boom, done.
Yeah,
Baby Driver is entertaining. I mean, and I think Edgar Wright, Edgar Wright just makes entertaining movies. And he hasn't made many movies. He's definitely made, he's made six enough. Now? But what'd you say?
Yeah, six now?
Six, like, real movies. I know he did something with Grindhouse, but, like, six, like, real movies. But he got started almost 20 years ago now. So he's putting one out about every 3 years. And I don't think he's missed yet. And I haven't seen Last Night in Soho, but I don't think he's missed yet. And I just wonder what it's going to take for somebody like Edgar Wright to, like, get to a level of, like, critical acclaim beyond just, like, Rotten Tomatoes. Does that make sense? Like, he gets good Rotten Tomatoes scores, and people like him, but he's not a household name. And most people don't know that he directed Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, The World's End, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World in this. Like, we know, but people who aren't, like, huge movie fans, he's not a name like a Kubrick or a Steven Spielberg or anything like that. So I wonder what it's going to take for him to hit that level, because he's made some, like, great indie action comedy movies, but he hasn't gone that one step further.
Honestly, I don't know if he wants to. Like, if he's willing to shoot down Marvel, right? If he's willing to shoot down and walk away from that. And his Ant-Man, Kevin Feige of Marvel, says that Edgar Wright's Ant-Man movie is the best movie he ever saw. Mm-hmm. And that nothing will ever come close to the movie that Edgar Wright was making for Marvel. They were so far into production when he stepped away from that to make this movie instead. Like, Edgar Wright doesn't care. Yeah. He just likes making movies. He feels like the type of person who just enjoys his art, and he puts his heart and soul in everything. And that's why his movies are so enjoyable, because you can tell this is someone who takes so much care and detail into the work that he does. And he just loves it. And he loves sharing it with people.
And that's why I think he does have, like, a following like you and like, who will put a lot of his movies into their top 20 and everything like that. And I think he just makes characters that you can connect with in a very simple bare minimum way. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't do. So that's good.
Yeah. And he also uses good music in his movies, and it really helps.
Yeah. Good music in movies is really unfair. When the music starts going, if you have a killer soundtrack, your movie is automatically elevated. I mean, Boogie Nights, we're talking about the next time we do our top 100. I mean, might be the best soundtrack in the history of film, and it's up there. I mean, it doesn't stop. It's unrelenting. It's so good. All right, but let's move on. What was the best thing you watched this week?
I can't believe I'm about to say this. No one is going to believe that I'm about to say this, except for you, who I already told I watched this. It was Metropolitan.
Yes.
The best movie I watched this week was a Whit Stillman movie.
I love that.
It happened. Now, to be fair, I didn't watch a lot because I was on vacation, but I still watched this Whit Stillman movie. I watched Metropolitan. I feel like I understand Whit Stillman a lot better. Maybe the topic of Metropolitan just entices me more than Barcelona and Last Days of Disco, but I'm just used to it now, I guess. I'm used to what he brings to a film, and I can enjoy it.
It's funny because I think that's my least favorite of his movies. I really do. Love and Friendship is my least favorite, but I think that's my third, like, out of, like, that trilogy, air quote, I think that's my least favorite one. But I love Last Days of Disco and Barcelona. Barcelona was in my top 100. We already talked about that. And I made you talk about Last Days of Disco, and that's probably going to be in my next top 100. So,
yeah.
Finally got
it. What about you? What was the best thing you watched this week?
All Quiet on the Western Front. I loved it. I really did. I thought it was great. And, like, I watched 1931, and I like older movies, but I don't love older movies like the way some people do. But I can appreciate it. I thought the original was okay. I thought there was some great filmmaking in it, but it just didn't connect with me on an emotional level. Like, I thought a movie like Wings was just better, even though it's silent and, you know, a couple years earlier, but I thought it connected with me on a more emotional level. I thought this All Quiet was great. I mean, I just thought that he really nailed it. Every element that he needed to hit, I thought he hit, and it resonated. I thought it was disturbing. I thought it was intriguing, like, showed war as hell without, like, feeling overly preachy. I got it as my second favorite of the year behind Banshees. I really thought, well, second favorite Best Picture nominee. I still think Northman is better, but I loved it. I thought it was great. And a close second was Avatar 2, which I gave 1 star, and I don't need to explain why I thought it was bad, because it wasted enough of my time. Yeah, but no, All Quiet on the Western Front, I thought it was great. I really did.
Yeah, it was really good.
All right, well, we'll be talking more about All Quiet on the Western Front next week when we do our Oscar preview. So let's talk now, though, instead about Psycho, my number 12 from 1960, not the Gus Van Sant shot-for-shot remake that was in color and had Vince Vaughn playing Norman Bates. John, this one came in, I believe it's 34 for you. I think it was 34 on your list. I always get confused, but I think it's 34 on your list. Either way.
Yeah,
34, sure. So we both have this one pretty high. Psycho, for me, is quintessential Alfred Hitchcock. I think this is the best Hitchcock movie by a lot. I really like Alfred Hitchcock's movies for the most part, but I do think some of them are pretty dated. This is just not dated. And, you know, he was always like the master of macabre. Like, you know, he was always known for what he could do with suspense and everything like that. And even if that meant that a guy in Strangers on a Train was going to have a 47-foot long arm so that he could reach down into the sewer grate and grab whatever, he kind of gave it whatever because it was Alfred Hitchcock. You didn't care. You figured whatever. Psycho is perfect. Psycho really is just a perfect movie. It's so hard for me when I get to this point, because I say with Dr. Strangelove and Chinatown that maybe they'll move higher. Maybe Psycho will move higher. Maybe these are my three favorite movies of all time, and I just don't realize it yet. But I guess that's what happens when we get into our top 13, 14. I was watching Psycho, and my God, is the screenplay for Psycho just one of the most brilliant stories ever written. You have Janet Leigh as Marion Crane, and you know she's going to be your protagonist. She's new to film, so that's why her name comes last in the credits with "and her." But you just know where this is going. She's going to go there. You know it's been sold as wait until you see what happens in the bathroom, all that. You know you're going into a horror movie. But the decision for Hitchcock to kill Marion Crane might be the most important decision ever from a storytelling perspective in film history. It changed so much in film, because then it was, you could no longer trust directors at that point, because you just killed your protagonist, who isn't a good person. She is an anti-hero. So the way that this is set up is, woman goes to motel after stealing money, gets to motel, has a conversation with this guy, and realizes she needs to change. Now, what most horror movies would do after that is torture the shit out of this woman, ruin her life, make everything difficult for her, put obstacles in front of her as she tries to survive, all that good stuff. But ultimately, she would defeat the bad guy. And instead, as she is taking the shower that is washing away her sins, she gets brutally murdered. And now we don't have a protagonist, and we're an hour into the movie. It's just too good to even explain. And that's the iconic part of this movie. But all of the storytellers, who's that buried in Greenview Cemetery? Martin Balsam's Arbogast is one of the best detectives ever. And he's in 3 minutes of the movie. The decision for her to go on the run and do all the wrong things and pretty much just be like so transparent the entire time. It's all great. And it all boils down to, okay, we know Norman Bates is messed up, but he's covering for his mother. A boy would do anything for his mother. And then you find out Norman Bates is his mother. Yeah. What the hell is going on? It's it unfolds so perfectly. It is one of the best plotted movies of all time. The suspense is always up, and the score is just horrifying. The score is so good, and those strings, and when she's driving in the car, and when that, the part, I get chills thinking about it, and then I swear I'm going to let you talk, but I get chills thinking about it. When she is driving, and she stops at the light, and her boss walks across the street right in front of her, and he turns around and looks at her, and she takes a deep breath, and he does a double take, and then she goes, all of a sudden, you just hear boom, like the music just kicks in. It is unreal. It is so freaking good because you're like, something bad is going to happen to this woman, and she kind of deserves it at this point. Although you don't think it's going to be as bad as what it is. But anyway, go ahead. This is, I know it's your 34. I got to let you talk.
It's my 34. You know what? You might not know if this is moving up in your rankings. It's definitely moving up in mine. Mm-hmm. My God, this is a film that just gets better every time you watch it.
It does.
Every aspect. Like, it starts, and that Bernard Herrmann score is going, and you're just like, oh, this is iconic. It sends this, like, this massive sensory feeling through you. Everything. It sets it up. We get the, like, you know, this torrid love affair between Marion Crane and Sam Loomis right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And, like, you're immediately put into the place where Marion Crane is not a moral person. This is the way that she is being framed in this movie. Now that is a very 1960s viewpoint of the film when it comes to her and Sam's relations, but still, that's the way it's being framed. It's the tool that's being used at the beginning of this film. And it's funny because we go in and we keep learning all these things about Marion Crane. We get her at her job, and I think one of my favorite moments of this film is when the other woman is there at the job and says, oh, he was flirting with you. He must have noticed my wedding ring. It's kind of to this point where it's to lessen the impact of Marion Crane, right?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, she's a little amoral because of what she's doing, and then she steals this money. You're like, oh, she's bad. And this was a time, like, slasher movies, Peeping Tom exists outside of this. It came out earlier in 1960. That is the only other slasher at this time.
And Diabolique. Have you seen Diabolique?
I have not seen Diabolique. It is on my list. Diabolique. I haven't watched it yet.
Although I guess Diabolique isn't so much of a slasher film, but you should watch Diabolique. Yeah. It's similar to this movie.
But at this point, like, we think we know where this film is going, but Hitchcock is taking it into a world nobody has seen before. This feels like this movie, like you said, we're following Marion Crane. We think she's gonna get it to her, but we think it's gonna be this crime film, right? Where the cops are looking after her, everything's setting up for the cops to look after her. Her boss walks across the street as she's fleeing town. She goes and she parks on the side of the road, and a cop comes and talks to her. She goes, changes her car, and a cop's like, "That's sketchy. I should check that out." Everything is leading us to believe Marion Crane is going to be caught. We see her go into the room with her numbers and, like, writing down figures and everything with this money and subtracting from 40,000. Pretty arbitrary way of figuring out someone is exactly there, but I digress. But
yeah,
we see all this happening, and we see her interactions with Norman Bates. We see her using a fake name in the hotel ledger. And then she gets killed.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you just have no idea what's going to happen at this point, because even from today's standpoint, when you watch a modern slasher film, you still have that final girl. And Psycho doesn't introduce you to its final girl until halfway through the film.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know. And so something that I really appreciate with this movie is, like you said, with her being amoral, you can look and roll your eyes and say, oh, in 1960, women couldn't do this, couldn't do that. Okay, but that's the time that this movie is set. So if the movie came out in 2023, but it was set in 1960, it would be a little weird if people were looking at her in a normal light and being like, oh, she's not married and she's sleeping around. Like, you know, nowadays we don't really care, but in 1960, that was a big deal. And if you set a movie in 1960, it should still be a big deal. And so, but what Hitchcock does is, by doing that and showing her her like reluctance to what her and Sam are both reluctant. Like neither her nor Sam is great. Their intentions are there, but their intentions are carnal, right? Like their intentions aren't pure. To do that and set her up as like a woman who will do what she needs to do to fulfill her desires. And then she's handed $40,000. Well, now she can fulfill her desires. So what will she do? She's going to go on the run. She doesn't need her husband, but they know that she's going towards where Sam Loomis is because that is who she has the relationship with. So she's driving that way. What's interesting is, though, she's driving east from California. There's really no other direction to go. So, of course, she's driving that way. We don't actually know if her intention was to go to Sam Loomis. Like, we don't, like, I don't think we're ever told that.
Isn't, she's in Phoenix, isn't she?
Oh, she's sorry, you're right. She is in Phoenix,
She's going west towards Sam.
That's true. But, again, if you're in Phoenix in 1960, to drive east, the only thing east of Phoenix is Albuquerque, and that's a solid 8 hours away. So you drive west, you go to California, and maybe you go see Sam, maybe you don't. I mean, if you have $40,000 in 1960 LA, it doesn't matter really if you go to see your boyfriend or not. You could have a good time. So anyway, yeah, I forgot that she's going that way, not coming. But I just like, I love that we don't really know her intentions because there's nobody else for her to talk about, like talk to. So then there's the other parts are like when we're getting the voiceover while she's driving and we hear the conversations playing out and it's like, oh, she didn't come in on Monday. She didn't do this. She didn't do that. That like once I had seen somebody said that that was a mistake in the movie where it's like, but you said she left 3 days ago and, but it's only the next day, whatever. When did this happen? It's not a mistake in the movie. She's thinking about those conversations. Those conversations aren't actually happening. She's imagining them, and that smile that's coming across her face as she realizes they're pretty much never going to be able to find her. She loves that. She's escaped. She's done it. She's taken the money and run.
Mm-hmm. And like, let's talk about this money because like $40,000 might not seem like a lot of money to run away with.
I would take 40 grand and
run. I would take $40,000 and run. But yeah, like that's like worth 10 times as much now.
Mm-hmm.
It's at close least to 400,000. No, I just did the, I looked it up before I made the comment.
Well, it's
just shy of $400,000.
But I will say this. What was he? He was buying his daughter a house, right?
Yeah.
You're buying a $40,000 house in Phoenix in 1960. That house is probably closer to 20 times the value because Phoenix has blown up so much since 1960. Like Phoenix is the safe hold in Arizona at this point. That's where you go if you don't want to live. Trust me, when my wife's family lives in Arizona and all the signs around election time are either make Phoenix, California or don't make Phoenix, California. Like those are what every billboard says the entire time because everybody moves from California to Phoenix.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway, yeah. No, that's $40,000 is enough. And when you're a single woman with nothing holding you back and it's all cash,
yeah.
I mean, she pays and what did a car cost? $500?
Yeah. And I mean, she just switched her car, right? She traded her car in for another one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's simple. It's so simple. It feels like a crime that's so easy to get away with. And this is a time when we didn't have cameras on every street corner to find her, right? We get Radagast is going hotel to hotel trying to find this woman along this route.
Yeah.
Like, that's just the times. And this is us just talking about Marion Crane. We haven't even talked about anything else in this film yet. We haven't talked about the fact that Anthony Perkins is absolutely phenomenal.
Top five performance of all time. It really is. It's a top five performance of all time. He's unreal. Like, it's too good. Best part, no Oscar nomination for him.
Of course
not. None.
This wasn't even a time where we had a stigma towards horror films in the Oscars.
I know. But yeah, Anthony Perkins is amazing. Norman Bates goes down as one of the most iconic villains of all time. And Norman Bates isn't in the first 40 minutes of this movie. And then Norman Bates almost becomes your protagonist because he's just trying to protect his mother.
Yeah.
And you almost want him to be okay. You want him to kind of succeed because he is who you think is going to be redemptive. He's being abused by his mother, and this woman just died, and he has to cover it up, but he's doing it for his mother, and you almost hope that he's going to be the one who eventually turns on his mother.
Yeah, and you're driven by this idea of, like, sympathy for the character.
Yeah.
Hitchcock has framed Norman Bates, and almost entirely because of Anthony Perkins' performance. Like, doesn't matter how the script is written and how the sets are designed and everything, without Anthony Perkins in this role, we don't feel the same way about Norman Bates as we do end up feeling in this film. You feel so sympathetic for him. This moment where he comes into the hotel room, we're pretty sure at this point that Mrs. Bates is the murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And you see him find the body and then, like, goes to those lengths to cover it up. That's that moment where you're like, this isn't the first time he's done this. And, like, these are the lengths he's going to.
Mm-hmm. That's the big one, right? You realize it's not the first time. And at the end of the movie, you find out it's not the first time. It's happened a lot. But what's funny is you said we're pretty sure Mrs. Bates killed him. No. We're 100% certain Mrs. Bates killed her. We are 100% certain. That, I think, is the best. And what's the first thing you see when they show the house in this movie?
Mrs. Bates in the window.
In the window. You see Mrs. Bates in the window. Marion Crane beeps the horn. Mrs. Bates disappears from the window. Anthony Perkins, a couple minutes later, comes sprinting out of the house because he had to take off the wig and take off the dress. You see Mrs. Bates in the window first thing, and she's moving. That's the other huge thing, is you see this woman moving, and you have no reason not to trust that this is real. No reason whatsoever to not trust that. Why? Who else would be living in that house? He's not going to be living there alone.
Yeah, exactly. So
that is brilliant. That is a brilliant decision to do that.
Yeah. And then we get these conversations. Norman seems like such a normal guy. Like, he's a little creepy, but he just seems like he's being friendly to Marion the entire time. And even to the point where, I mean, we do get the creep factor, obviously, with the spy hole scene, which is iconic. Again, like, we keep talking about these iconic moments in this film. And there's just so many of them. Like, this is easily Hitchcock's best movie. Beyond the one that I have ranked higher than it, obviously. But, like, it's between this and Vertigo, depending on who you talk to. And, like, it makes sense that people will lean Psycho over Vertigo, because Vertigo's the noir and this is the horror film. So it's, you know, whatever floats your boat there. But this has so many shots that you have seen emulated over and over again in so many different things. And yet, sometimes you just can't remember it's from this. And then you see it in this movie, and you're like, oh, that's it. I was watching The Simpsons last week. I think it's Marge on the Lamb, maybe, is the episode. It's one of the earlier episodes. And Marge is, like, washing her hands. Oh, it's the episode where Marge accidentally steals the whiskey from the Quickie Mart.
Okay.
She's, like, washing her hands in the Flander house, and Maude lifts a picture up to watch her washing her hands. And it's like, it's those little moments that Hitchcock provides in this film that we can see parodied or referenced and alluded to over and over again because they're so iconic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what sets this one apart. I like this one a lot more than Vertigo. And I think the reason why I like this one so much more than Vertigo is because Vertigo has one scene in it that I will never, ever forgive. And that is the letter writing scene that is then immediately ripped up. I cannot forgive that scene.
Sure.
Psycho, it all unfolds so naturally. And what I think is so amazing about Psycho, and why I put this one as my favorite of his, is he tells you everything right away. You know Marion Crane stole the money. You know she is fleeing and that her intentions are bad. You know that Mrs. Bates murders Marion Crane. You know that Norman is covering it up for his mother. You know that now Sam Loomis and Arbogast and Marion Crane's sister are going to come to Norman. You know everything until you get to the sheriff. And the sheriff says, well, no, there was that double. Yeah, no, Norman took it hard. He found them in bed together. And all of that. No, Norman murdered them, but they don't know that yet. And yeah, I went up and talked to Norman, and there was nobody else there. He was home alone, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And who's that buried? Who's that buried in Greenlawn Cemetery is one of those chill-inducing moments where you're like, who the fuck is that buried in Greenlawn Cemetery? Like, you better tell me right now. That's the stuff. I watched this movie so many times. And the shower scene as a little kid used to scare the daylights out of me. And my dad thought that was funny. So he would throw it on all the time. And he was one. I mean, my sister's favorite movie as a child was, everybody else is sitting around rewatching Disney movies. She's rewatching Jaws. So I'm talking like she's 3-4 years old watching Jaws over and over again. But I always loved this movie. And I sat down in high school. I think it was my senior year or junior year, whatever it was. And I watched this with, I think it was my girlfriend at the time and one of my friends, and neither one of them was really that into movies. And we watched this one night. And I remember after the murder happened, they were so on edge. And these were the types of people who like would be scared shitless by like the Amityville Horror remake.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, like those types. They were so on edge. And I remember after it ended, I think somebody in my family just came down the stairs and we didn't hear them come down the stairs, and they walked in the room and my friend screamed at the top of his lungs because he was so on edge, and he wasn't that type of person. You know what I mean? Like, but this movie, this was probably in 2009, 2010, it was 49, 50 years old. This movie scares the daylights out of people now. Like, it still scares the daylights out of people because it's so real. Like, it just feels so real. And you're like, where is this going to go? It's so unsettling. And I think horror movies nowadays try really hard to be unsettling. And oftentimes they fall short of actually being unsettling.
Yeah.
This movie is just unsettling. And yet you don't see a lot of blood and gore. Actually, you see Hershey syrup. You don't see all the murders taking place. You hear it, but you're not seeing it. You don't see the bodies piling up and this and that. It's what's happening in your imagination. Mm-hmm. And that is so much scarier, you know, a lot of the time. And I think that's what's great about this. You know this guy. So now we know Marion Crane is the way she is. We also know, because Norman is looking through the peephole, that he's a weird guy. He made that peephole so he could look in that room where he has definitely put other women. But he's also like living with his mom and he's lonely and it makes sense. Whatever, he's a peeping Tom. Whatever. Like, it is what it is. It's creepy, but it is what it is. But you know his intentions aren't good, but you never think it's to the extreme that it actually is.
Yeah. And even then, Hitchcock lays it all out for us the entire film.
I know.
We get to the parlor and we have this entire conversation about how much he loves taxidermy.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Like, it shouldn't be a surprise to us when it turns out that he's preserved his mother's corpse at the end of the film. Like, that shouldn't be a surprise because Hitchcock laid it all out. But we just get to but it's so different than anything else.
Yeah.
And because it's such an iconic twist, you can't emulate it either.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. So many people have tried to emulate a very similar ending like this, but it just doesn't work. Like, you can try to pull the wool over people's eyes, but like when we talk about like Usual Suspects with its great ending, this is probably the best twist ending ever, like Psycho. Because what gets lost on people now is that you don't find out Norman is the one pretending to be his mother until the last 3 minutes of the movie. It feels like you find that out at the halfway point when you just think about the movie, because that's when Marion Crane dies. You don't find that out until the very end. And when you're watching this movie for the first time, that scene when she dies feels like it's the most shocking part of the movie. But it's not. It's not the most shocking part of the movie. The most shocking part of the movie is that Norman is his mom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, and to end this film with an exposition dump, such a bold decision, but for some reason it just works so well in this case, because you as an audience need to understand what's happening here.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think that it might feel like it's too much of an exposition dump, but it's also the psychologists and the cops figuring out what's going on too. Like, they're finding it out alongside you. And then it ends with an absolutely creepy thank you. They think I would hurt that fly. I wouldn't even hurt a fly. And like, to go back to that after the exposition dump, we realize like, yeah, no, he's 100% Mrs. Bates now. Like, it's over. Yeah. It's horrifying. Like, it really is horrifying. And, you know, like, when you look at the slasher movies that came after it, like Halloween, which I know you had in your top 100, and like other movies along
those. I used Halloween to replace Psycho earlier in my top 100.
Oh, okay. That's what it was. Okay. So Halloween was a replacement. Okay.
Scream, but like, when you look at the other one that's in there,
what was it?
Scream's the other slasher in my top 100.
Oh, Scream. Yeah. But when you look at like the other serious, like, trying to be horror, not trying to like dissect the trope. The Friday the 13th, the Nightmare on Elm Street, mm-hmm. none of them can get to this level because they all try to go for the schlock, the kill them and show the boobs and like, let's move on. Yeah. Hot people having sex, woohoo. And Psycho wasn't worried about that. Psycho brought you into an attractive single woman who is amoral and a creepy, lonely guy who is doing his best to talk to her, but doesn't really know how.
Yeah.
That's what it decided to do. And I think a lot of this, I mean, I think a big part of the reason why Anthony Perkins works so well here is because Hitchcock was kind of a perv. I mean, that's pretty well known at this point. And I think he knew exactly what he wanted from this movie and how he wanted Anthony Perkins to play it. And Anthony Perkins is perfect. I mean, Anthony Perkins is absolutely perfect in this movie. And it's a shame with Anthony Perkins because he never went on to do anything else. And he died. I think he died at like 40 or 45. He was very, very young. He died of AIDS. He died at 60. Never mind. He was older than I thought he was. But yeah, he did. He died of AIDS as far as I remember. I believe that's what happened. But he never really picked up anything like to this level again, which was surprising. But, you know, I guess he didn't fit into what they were looking for.
Yeah. It's unfortunate because man, if he was given an opportunity, I'm sure he could have carried so many films.
Oh yeah.
Because he carries this, and it's that innocence he brings to the character while still being this imposing character at the same time. So those moments where in the parlor, I think the parlor is really great because there's that moment where he realizes Marion gave him a fake name.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you feel he's onto her. So you feel that threat. And then when Arbogast comes later and wants to look at the ledger and everything, and he's like, lying about having seen Marion and everything, right? Like, you're like, oh, Arbogast, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
You feel the imposing force that is Norman Bates, despite how timid Anthony Perkins is playing him.
Yeah. No, and for sure, I think this movie deals heavily in power. Mm-hmm. And the power dynamic shifts over and over and over and over again throughout this entire movie. Who's got the power? Who's got the power? Who's got the power? And realistically, Norman Bates has the power of the whole movie. Because even when Arbogast is questioning him or when Sam Loomis is questioning him, whenever they're doing that, he's kind of just, he's being a smartass, or he doesn't care, or like, what, he knows he's going to kill these people. It doesn't matter because he's done it so many times. He knows that when he's pushed to the brink, he's going to turn into his mother and he's going to kill whoever. And the scene where Marion's sister goes down in the basement and turns around Mrs. Bates is just like, it's great. I mean, it's because you're still sitting there and you're like, oh, so she is real. She's just sitting there. And then when it turns around, you're like, all of it hits you kind of at once where it's almost hard to like really take it all in. But you're like, how messed up is this guy? And not for nothing, how ballsy to make that movie in 1960. I found out while watching it this time, Walt Disney refused to let Alfred Hitchcock, I think Alfred Hitchcock wanted to shoot something for Alfred Hitchcock Presents in Disney World or Disneyland. It was Disneyland because Disney World wasn't around when Disney was still alive. But he wanted to shoot something in Disneyland, and Walt Disney wouldn't let him because he made that disgusting picture, Psycho.
Yeah. Well,
Disney, I mean, groundbreaking.
How dare Alfred Hitchcock show a toilet on screen?
Dude, that was a big deal, huh?
Yeah. First time in cinema history, a toilet is seen on screen and we hear a toilet flushing.
So weird. It's so weird what's considered like a big deal and what's not.
Yeah.
It really is. So funny. You got anything else on Psycho?
Nah, Hitchcock's just a master. Like, it's just what it came down to. Hitchcock just made some really good movies.
Yeah. Yeah, this movie's, this is one of my favorites, and I, this is my highest ranked, it's my highest ranked horror movie. So there you go. Numero uno. Well, like we said, next week, we're going to be doing our Oscar predictions. So that'll be on Wednesday, March 8th after Survivor. We will come on here and we will do our Oscar predictions. And I'll beat John for the third year in a row, even though he watches all the movies.
I might not actually get them all in by Wednesday. I'm not going to lie. I have run out of English speaking films and I have to pay a lot more attention to the foreign films.
Yeah, that's true. I know. I got to get my biggest one right now is I just got to watch Tar. That's like 2 hours and 42 minutes. I have the DVD, but like, I just have to watch it. It's just a long watch.
Elvis is pretty long too.
I know, but Elvis is just easier to watch because it's like on
you say like, that, but that's because you haven't seen Tom Hanks' performance in Elvis.
No, I'm saying from like a standpoint of accessibility, I'm traveling for the next 4 days, like Elvis will be able to be seen over the next 4 days, whereas Tar I have to watch either Monday or Tuesday of next week before we podcast. But we'll be doing that next week, and then when we come back, our top 11, our number 11 movies are The Road from 2009 for John and Boogie Nights from 1997 for me. So those will be the movies the 15th, but for the 8th, we're just doing Oscar predictions. So tune in for that next week. This way you can win your Oscar pool. Otherwise, bye, everybody. Thanks for listening.
All right.